Weekly Pulse Sunday. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, joined always by my co-host, George Grumbacher, who is the founder and host of the Money Savage podcast. George, great to talk to you.
Always great to talk to you, man. It's Friday. Everybody's in a good mood.
Yeah, it is Friday, unless you got to work Saturday and Sunday. But yeah, it's been a great week. And actually, I'm doing the traveling this week. So I'm in Washington, D.C., attending the NAGDA conference, and that's the National Association of Government-Defined Contribution Administrators. So those are all the state, local government, municipal government-defined contribution administrators. So there's a roundtable that happens once a year, so I'm here.
Got it. Pretty late nights at the NAGDA conference?
Yeah. Actually, it's a pretty raucous crowd.
Okay.
I'm not going to out anybody, but sure. Yeah, there's definitely people who are out late. No, I went to bed at 8 o'clock because I actually had to do a presentation or lead a discussion. So I went to bed at like 8:39 because, you know, I have to get my beauty sleep.
Yeah.
So a little bit. So you and I are like night and day as it relates to travel, I guess, apparently.
Yeah. We are on different travel schedules as of late.
It is. And so I should also say that I'm hosting, obviously I'm in D.C., hosting the podcast from the National Association of Counties here in D.C. as well. So they've been very kind in allowing me to work out of their space. So not an endorsement, no money exchanging hands, but very favorable in terms of us working out of the office. So great to have a great show with you and great to talk to you.
Yeah, man. Should be a great show for sure. Super excited for tomorrow. I think that sometimes when the people are listening, they're going to assume that I'm some kind of a crazy sports nut, which I'm not. Mm-hmm. I like sports. But the University of Minnesota Duluth, my boyhood home, are in the national championship for ice hockey tomorrow night. So
that's exciting.
Go Bulldogs.
Very cool. And who are they playing?
They are playing Notre Dame.
Wow. Wow, that's good. That's amazing. So the Frozen Four was last week, and this is the finals.
Yeah, it was last night. Actually, it was the Frozen Four. So
I missed it. I was at the NAGDA conference. I'm so sorry.
Right. Hey, no problem. But once again, all eyes of the sports world are on Northern Minnesota between curling and now the Frozen Four. Who knew? Who knew?
Wow, you're not biased. So George, it's been an up and down week with the market. We're going to check in a little bit in a few minutes with our friends from Bloomberg and TD Ameritrade Network, Kevin Kelly and Oliver Rennick. We've also got, Allie, she went on vacation. Can you believe that?
Kind of selfish.
I know it is selfish. We got to talk to her. She went abroad. She's in Europe. So maybe she can share some European personal finance with us when she's back. But in her place, we've got her colleague, Jacob Passy from MarketWatch. And then we've got a great interview, Carolyn McKinnon. So on the heels of Lisa Messina from the state of Oregon several weeks ago, we now have Carolyn McKinnon, who is the director of the new Washington State retirement marketplace. So that'll be an interesting conversation. And then last and certainly not least, we are privileged. Kevin took the week off, so Kevin Walsh, not Kevin Kelly. And we got to make sure we do those intros correctly, or I do. Kevin Walsh is taking the week off, and we've got his colleague, David Levine from Groom Law. And David is a noted author and panelist at many of our industry functions. So this is shaping up to be a really cool show, I think.
Awesome. Let's get into it, man.
All right, let's do it. All right, George, well, we're kicking things off. We've got our experts, Bloomberg's Kevin Kelly. Kevin, I got your name right. Congratulations to me.
2 weeks
and,
in a row.
That's amazing. And TD Ameritrade Network's Oliver Rennick, both joining us to catch us up on what's going on with the market. Guys, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jeff.
And before we start, I understand that everyone here is probably drinking some type of tea or caffeinated beverage. George just told me that he was drinking green tea. And Kevin's drinking green tea. Oliver, what are you drinking?
I'm in a dry period right now between shows, but in time for Market on Close, I will be going heavy black tea with enough honey for a small Asiatic bear.
Very, very cool. Well, good.
If we could hold on for a second, I don't know my bears well enough. Did you say Asiatic?
Asiatic, picturesque, spectacled bear. It's a little deep in the zoology game. It's another talent of mine.
Asiatic, excellent. Thank you. Appreciate that.
See, that's what happens when you come to the Weekly Pulse Sunday podcast. You learn about caffeinated drinks and you learn about bears. So, Nick, maybe we'll do the next show from a zoo.
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
That'd be cool.
That's guys, right there. So,
yeah, that'd be a great show. Maybe you could take TD Ameritrade Network on location. Okay. So, guys, it's been an up and down week for the market. Who wants to start? Who wants to give us their assessment for the week?
Hey, I think I went last time. I'll let Kev take the helm.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this one's hopefully a shorter update. I mean, it's basically been same old, same old. You're seeing, and same old, same old. I mean, now it's a lot of tariff talk has become very much the mainstream. Up and down volatility in the markets. I think we're kind of in this interesting sell first, ask questions later type period, or sell first, run fundamental analysis type period. But there is, I think there is some weight that you can put on potential tariff talks recently. Our team did a little work on this week, just comparing, you know, what industries or sectors might be most affected overall for the equity market. I mean, it's just a lot of, as I said, kind of intraday or intra volatility that's taken place. Overall in the week, we actually finished, we were up yesterday. We finished, if you mark the peak yesterday, we're up about 80 basis points. Now on the week, we're down a few, you know, 30 basis points. So it's not a huge week-over-week move. There hasn't been different sector rotation, anything that really leads us to believe as of yet we're necessarily out of this corrective period we've seen in stocks. But as we get a little bit more clarity surrounding tariffs, and as we really get into Q1 earnings season, that's what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. I think what we need is to get into Q1, have companies come out and really reassure the market that, you know, yes, we've talked about this on the show before, valuations, you know, are higher than average. But growth expectations are definitely up there. EPS expectations or earnings growth expectations are still positive and trending higher. So what we should see, hopefully, is Q1 starts, earnings come out. Companies reassure the market that, you know, they are profitable and that earnings growth is strong, and that hopefully puts the market on a little bit more solid footing.
Yeah, I think Kevin makes a lot of good points there, especially on the earnings front. There's a lot at stake because within the sort of pro-con list of the equity market right now, the biggest quote-unquote tailwind is this much purported double-digit earnings growth, 17% in the first quarter that's expected, and some big growth within some certain sectors. But that we know that there was a huge move up for those expectations at the beginning of the year. So how much tax reform actually shows up? Are companies spending in a way that investors like? Are they buying back shares? They've announced all these things. Are they going to help the bottom line for earnings? And is it going to be enough to sustain those high expectations? Is going to be hugely important. I think last week I talked about how that 200-day moving average sat right at the 30-year average PE for the S&P 500. And that's going to be really telling because I think this week you might be tempted to say there's sort of signs of rotation that appear, but the groups in the S&P 500 and the stock market as a whole that have been doing okay since that February 8th bottom are utilities up about 6%, real estate holding on in there. Even this past week, we saw some strength in staples when the market sold off, but all three of those groups have such serious issues. If rates continue to climb, then your first two groups, utilities and REITs, have a pretty tough battle, and there's just so much fundamentally happening to challenge some of those staples. I'm not really sure if there's any place to hide sector-wise that fundamentally makes a ton of sense. So I guess just hold on for the ride and see what tech does.
Nice. Obviously, tariffs are still in the news, and I know, Kevin, you mentioned that you guys were doing research and trying to figure out how, if they go through or what industries will be affected. I was curious this morning, if I was really confident that tariffs were going to go through, what's an example of a trade that I could make? Would it be me shorting something? Would it be me going long in a certain sector?
Sure, absolutely. I think using a specific example, one industry that could potentially see some pressure, again, just based on what the proposals were this week, right, from the tariff talk and the lists that have come out, and then the retaliation from the other side, China's retaliation. I think one of the interesting ones that we're watching, and again, this plays into the tech trade that we've talked the last couple weeks about, because again, tech's led the market, tech's the biggest part of the market, is semiconductors. That's an interesting space. Typically, when you see semiconductors not perform, the tech sector, it's usually a leading indicator for the tech sector. And so what we've seen is some weakness in semiconductors recently. They would be, you know, affected by some of these proposed tariffs. And what's interesting, that if you actually look at some of these big semiconductor names, the Micron Technologies, Qualcomm, Broadcom, more than a few of them drive a majority of their revenue from China, actually. So what China's doing right now is, in a sense, almost it's twofold. One, there's the tariff talk that would affect the revenues that come from China for these U.S. Semiconductors. And the flip side is that China's trying to make their semiconductor market much more competitive. But they're taking certain actions to kind of subsidize those companies up there. So I think, you know, if you're trying to play this market, one of the pieces that or notes that we came out this week actually examined China tech as a whole. And we said, hey, listen, these companies technically traded a premium to their U.S. peers, but growth expectations are nearly double for China technology companies as a whole. And if you're looking at the valuation premium, it's pretty much in line with its historic average. It means that even as these Chinese tech companies do really, really well, right, they doubled the performance of U.S. peers last year, their valuations are still don't look overstretched relative to where they've historically traded. So that could be a potential opportunity for people looking for an alternative to this kind of overcrowded large cap tech trade in the U.S.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think it's where a lot of these concerns rely. You have now suddenly an existential risk to the sort of heart and soul of the bull market, which is semiconductors and tech. And to Kevin's point, when we had a pretty solid day on Thursday for the market, the semiconductor index did not take part in that. It got hit, and it's also continued to show that weakness. The one thing I would add that we thought was pretty interesting was how the reaction to China's response to things like soybeans and corn and some of these basic input products actually might have helped sort of the case for some of the staples companies like Hormel Foods, Campbell's Soup. Both of these were winners on this tariff discussion because, well, guess what? If there's lower demand, then you see prices go down for some of these raw agricultural goods. That's what we saw in the futures market for soybeans. Maybe that's a lower input cost for them. But again, you know, it's hard to think of this as anything outside of a trade just because Campbell's Soup is down at $43 from a high of 60 for a pretty good reason, and it's very fundamental. Same thing exists for a lot of companies within that sector. So you got to be real careful when you try to trade off these types of events.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's really great information, especially for those individual investors out there. You know, the thing we've been talking about for a long time is corporate pension funding ratios, and where they were up in January this year, they're actually down a point. And I would imagine, guys, this is tied directly to the market. Also, discount rates have decreased by 5 basis points in March. And I think that that's probably a result of the S&P 500 and the MSCI EAFE indexes also decreasing respectively. So just want to get your thoughts. I mean, there's that institutional impact, which also impacts individuals as well.
Yeah.
Hugely. Go ahead, Kevin.
All right. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's you're spot on. That was definitely affected by the market. What I find interesting too about, you know, discount rate in general is that when you look at forecasting, you know, a common way in which you can forecast potential return is looking, at least in the equity market, looking at those starting valuations, right? When the market, the S&P or the U.S. market, is trading at a higher, you know, price to earnings ratio, which is a metric used. Typically, you see the subsequent, you know, 10-year period after that with lower returns starts off at a higher multiple. Now we've got multiples that are back to, you know, pre-electricals, but almost levels we saw back in June of 2016, you know, when you had the whole Brexit talk. And what's interesting there is you still have discount rates coming down, which in theory if you start off with a lower valuation multiple, you could make the argument that your expected returns, oh, that's, again, stuff within 10-year period be higher. So it's just really interesting. I don't know what's right or wrong here, and we can have a debate about that all day. I think a 7.5% discount is still high, but it's just interesting to see how markets and people react to that. Whereas now valuations are, you know, again, still above historical average, but not nearly as stretched as they were heading into, you know, late January.
Yeah, I think you guys are a lot more entrenched in the discount rate conversation than I am. But from a big picture, I think that this is an important thing to continue to look at, Jeff. And I think you're onto something pretty crucial for many that are worried about a systemic risk to weaker equity markets, and that is the fact that institutions like pension funds that typically did not have this type of heavy allocation to risk assets or alternatives now are sort of trading, not trading, but are sort of more subject to the swings of a market in a late cycle, which many expect to have more swings on the way. So that is sort of a big ship that is kind of moving with what is that fable about stacking mattresses on a pea or something like that? That's kind of the picture I'm getting in my mind, which is swings in a market affecting big, big institutions that have potential for pretty large disruptions in assets.
Yeah. Well guys, I want to check in before we leave you. How is your tea consumption going?
I'm on my second glass.
How was your tea, Kevin?
I think it's...
Go ahead, Oliver.
I was just going to say, I did a little Google search here, and I believe it was Princess and the Pea is what I was looking for.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a strong reference.
You know, yes. for the audience, the great alternative to coffee. You know, heard it here first.
Yeah, that's... This is probably breaking news to a lot of the world that green tea is an alternative to coffee. So you're welcome, everyone.
I couldn't disagree more. It's like Splenda versus sugar. Come on. Tea is like I could drink a barrel of it and I don't even know if I'm awake.
And so, I want to know, can you do a Google search on how it impacts your 40-yard dash time? That's the question that we need
that is to be
out.
Determined.
That is
we'll get answers on the next one.
Absolutely. Well, guys, thanks so much for your time. Hope Oliver, enjoy the rest of your day. Have a great show.
Thanks,
Kevin,
Jeff.
Thanks so much for your insight. And we'll check you all next week.
Later.
Sounds good.
Guys. All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye, gang. Bye.
Welcome back. Had a great first segment with Oliver Rennick and Kevin Kelly. And now joining Jeff and I is Jacob Passy, the personal finance reporter, or a personal finance reporter with MarketWatch. Jacob, how are you?
I'm great. Glad to talk with all y'all.
Awesome.
That's great. It's good to have you. But how do you feel about Allie going on vacation?
You know, it always puts a little bit of pressure on us when one of our coworkers is out of the office to churn out even more stories and everything like that. And I'm definitely jealous of her she's visiting family over in Italy. So definitely a little envious.
Well, hopefully, George, they gave her an assignment to do personal finance stories in Europe.
Yeah.
Too good of an opportunity to miss, so hopefully.
Exactly.
Well, Jacob, we have the pleasure of a little bit later in the show talking to Carolyn McKinnon, who is an integral part of the Washington State's new retirement program, which just rolled out. And I know that we wanted to talk to you a little bit about how states, as opposed to action at the federal level, could really lead the charge for helping Americans with retirement. So,
yeah. So, you know, different states are taking different approaches to retirement planning. And it really seems like, you know, kind of nationwide, there does seem to be this push for states to, you know, create ways to make it easier for workers to, hide money away for retirement, because this is an issue that really impacts so many people. So, New York State Legislature recently approved a program in its budget for 2019 where it's going to be creating a state-run tax-advantaged retirement account for workers whose employers don't have employer-sponsored retirement plans. And so kind of the thinking there is, you know, when an employer has a sponsored plan, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. But when that's not in place, you know, it's so easy for folks, you know, with all the expenses you have on a on an ongoing basis to, you know, push retirement planning down on your to-do list. And obviously, you know, as you grow older, that becomes more and more of an issue. And you hear so much about people who are you know, struggling to save for retirement. So, you know, nationwide, more than 40 states have considered such a program since 2012. Only 9 have gone forward with one. But it definitely seems like, you know, this might be an innovation we see at the state level that could really make a huge difference in people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, this is Jeff again. I think that, this is a critical issue when you have many Americans are not covered by a retirement plan, like a 401k.
Right.
And many Americans work for small businesses, that, you know, maybe it's not cost effective to offer, if you have a 12 person firm, it may not be cost effective to do that. And I think, you know, this is one way to offer that type of benefit. Of course, there are lots of different solutions that are being talked about. You know, we talked to Lisa Messina from Oregon, where they have an auto IRA program. And then we, you know, you look at like Vermont, what they're doing with a multiple employer plan. And then we're going to get ready to talk to Cynthia soon. And they actually have a retirement marketplace. So George, yeah. I mean, this is really, it's really amazing.
Yeah, hopefully it helps to move the needle a little bit because, as we all know, we are not doing an awesome job with saving for retirement. So, and Jacob, another thing that I was curious to talk to you about, for those Americans who are working with a financial advisor or who are considering engaging, maybe that's the better way to do it, in considering engaging with a financial advisor, what questions would you suggest that person asks their new or their existing advisor?
Yeah. So first off, you know, they should ask to see some credentials, you know, and that can be an easy way of, you know, determining whether someone really is, you know, trained in providing that advice, or if they're kind of a fly-by-night type of person who is, you know, not necessarily going to have your best interests in mind. So so the SEC actually advises investors to, you know, check the backgrounds of any financial advisor they're going to work with. There's a website that the SEC has where you can find detailed reports on advisors, and those reports include, you know, past criminal activity and customer complaints. So you can look there. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority also has a database called BrokerCheck, which will, you know, give you information on their years of experience, what exams they've taken, what licenses they have. So that's a good starting point. You know, this is also something you need to figure out yourself. You know, it's good for consumers to know what the difference is between, you know, because advisors use so many different titles. They may not just refer to themselves as an advisor. They may say that they're a wealth manager or a financial consultant. So you know, looking out for designations like CFP, you know, a CFP is a certified financial planner. They have to take an exam and get a certificate. They have to have 6,000 hours of related experience. You know, so those are people who are going through a rigorous training to get that certification. So, you know, asking them if they're a CFP is a great place to start. After that, you know, you should learn what products they have. You know, not all financial advisors will have the same offerings. You know, you should ask questions about, you know, what funds your portfolio would be invested in, you know, what product mix they suggest. You know, there is research that's shown that, you know, 2 out of 5 Americans don't know how their retirement portfolios are actually allocated. So, you know, asking those questions, you know, you can find out how aggressive they are. And you know, that can mean the difference between, you know, safe investments or even potentially, you know, losing money, depending on the strategy that they take.
Well, that is good advice. do a little bit of research, ask some questions. Yeah. I like it. Well, the jobs report, I'm going to be honest, I'm not sure if it's already come out or if it's coming out today, but that obviously gives us an indication of if there's job growth. Talking about Americans who are searching for a job, what are some of the challenging things associated with that?
Yeah, so the jobs report came out today, and what we learned was that the U.S. Economy added only 103,000 jobs in March, which is the smallest gain in the past 6 months. Some of that is seasonality. Some of that is, you know, the job market's also just getting really tight. You know, unemployment is still at the lowest level it's been in 17 years at 4.1%. That's the rate. And experts say it could go even lower because there is a record high number of job openings right now and everything. But the issue for Americans, especially those who are unemployed, and this may seem obvious, but researchers at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and Columbia Business School, you know, what they found is that, you know, unemployed people actually are at a disadvantage when it comes to the job hunt. The hourly wages that are offered to someone who is currently employed are 48% higher than what's offered to an unemployed worker on average. And 63% of the offers that unemployed individuals receive actually don't have any benefits, whereas only 40% of the offers that employed individuals receive come without benefits. So, you know, they're just, you know, they're getting paid generally less and they're not often getting benefits. And you know, there's the research showed that, you know, unemployed workers are actually getting more offers than employed workers, which is probably, you know, a virtue of them being more active on the job hunt, but they're accepting about half of the offers they receive. And so, you know, that makes sense because when you don't have a job, you know, you don't have the opportunity to be less discriminated or to be more discriminating with the offers you're receiving, which can inherently put you at a disadvantage. But the researchers also suggested, you know, there really is a stigma there around unemployment. Obviously, there are natural reasons why someone could be unemployed if there were just a round of layoffs at a company. You know, it doesn't necessarily point to that person being in any way, you know, inadequate at their job. But nevertheless, you know, you do see this bias that's really making it harder for unemployed people to get a leg up.
Yeah, it's probably trite to say it's chicken and the egg or a paradox,
yeah.
But that's sort of the way that it is.
No, totally, totally.
That was great stuff. Thank you so much for more than adequately filling Allie's shoes. And we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right.
Take care, Jacob. Have a good weekend.
All right. Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, George, that was a great conversation with MarketWatch's Jacob Passey. Obviously, a lot of good stuff going on from the personal finance side. You know, we've got a great guest, Carolyn McKinnon, who is the Marketplace Director for the new Washington State Retirement Marketplace, is on with us. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeffrey and George. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We are excited, right, George? I mean, we've been talking about this issue for a while.
I think that there's a lot of folks that have been trying to figure out how to put a dent in the American savings problem, and certainly on a state-by-state basis, that's people stepping up like Carolyn and like Washington to help the 2 million working Washingtonians that do not have access to a retirement plan. So it's a really important topic.
Yeah. So, Carolyn, thanks for joining us again. And, you know, I think it'd be great for the audience for you to kind of describe the marketplace, because we had Lisa Messina on a couple weeks ago from Oregon, and she talked about the IRA, auto IRA program. But the direction Washington State took is a little bit different. And I think it might be helpful for you to kind of outline that a little bit.
Well, you bet. Lisa is a great colleague of ours, and here in the Pacific Northwest, we want to be out on the leading edge of trying to solve this problem. And George, you're exactly right. Here in Washington, we have 2 million working Washingtonians who lack access to a plan. Now, that's 61% of our working workforce. So this is a substantial issue here in Washington. We also, if we want to look at it through the lens of how many employers are currently not offering a retirement plan to their workers, we've got 131,000 unserved business units. Now, most of them are small, but we even saw a significant increase in the number of large firms that don't offer a plan or stopped offering a plan in the wake of the Great Recession. So there's a high-level description of our problem. The problem is that Washingtonians, if they don't adequately save for retirement, are going to retire into a declining quality of life and increased reliance on the public safety net. And so it really is all of our problems to look at. So the approach that we took here in Washington was a consensus-based approach to getting to legislation that successfully passed a bipartisan legislature here in Olympia, Washington. That legislation passed in 2015, and indeed it's taken us 2.5 years to get this program off the ground, and I'll describe a little bit of some of our challenges later on. But what this approach is a voluntary online portal where we make it easy for employers and individuals to comparison shop for a state-verified but privately provided retirement savings plan.
And I can speak to the ease of it. I went on this morning, and even though I live in Arizona, I think I signed up for a Roth IRA. So, kidding, of course.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, actually, George, your point is that virtually anybody who is eligible to participate in a retirement savings plan can use a retirement marketplace. And our hope is that we can build some scale by inviting other states to participate in this retirement marketplace. So that's one of the you know, looking out over the horizon, one of the strategies that I think is important for us to talk with other states about. We think that a retirement marketplace could be a really viable component to any state policy on retirement security.
Now, you said that it took 2.5 years to actually, from the time the legislation passed to actually launching it. How much of that was simply building out the website and figuring out what it needed to look like and all that good stuff?
It was a substantial undertaking, and we have been fortunate to have competitively procured an outstanding developer, Redmond Technology Partners in Bellevue, Washington. They go by the name RedTech. They're our procured developer. And so we've spent just under 2 years with RedTech after a competitive procurement developing this platform. They use a Kentico platform. That's a proprietary content management system. It's fully scalable. It's robust. And that's one of the reasons I put on the table that, just like the ABLE programs where other states have partnered up to run the Achieving a Better Life Experience program, we think we have a scalable model here. So we've spent just short of 2 years developing the platform and simultaneously recruiting and vetting the plans and providers that we carry.
And I mean, that's, you know, these things do take time. I mean, this problem wasn't created in a day, and it's certainly going to take a lot of time to kind of solve these issues and kind of wrestle with the best way forward. But I think one of the things that I've come to really appreciate, especially in working with governments, as a consultant, is the way that you all share information. Washington State obviously on the cutting edge of a lot of retirement issues in addition to this one, but you all talk to one another. So, you know, whether it's, talking to folks in California or talking to people in Vermont, right? There's a collaboration between state governments in a lot of ways to kind of find that the optimal solution.
You're absolutely right. We have a state working group that talks with each other every month. We've built a lot of trust with each other, and I don't think I could be doing the job for Washingtonians that I do today without the encouragement and the intellectual bandwidth that people like Lisa Messina from Oregon Saves and all of the other talented folks working on this problem have shared with me. It's a really generous group. We have a shared mission, how we go about reaching our shared objective will vary a little bit, but I think this will evolve into a very effective public intervention and partnership with the private sector. And that's something I want to underscore with your listeners is Washington's approach really is a public-private partnership. We rely on the participation of our private sector providers to carry great plans that can, that are capable of being state verified.
Nice. Well, that is really, really, really great to hear that it's cooperative and you've built trust up and everybody's working together. So now that the doors to the marketplace are open, what do you see as the opportunities and challenges moving forward?
Well, our opportunities are to continue to grow the number of plans that we carry on the marketplace so that we can deliver the promise of choice to our business and our individual consumers. And so right now we have launched with 5 variations of a 401k plan offered by Saturna Trust and 2 IRAs, the Roth and the traditional, offered by FinHabits. We're continuing to recruit for providers. We need a payroll deduction IRA, a SEP, a simple, and more choices of IRAs and 401ks. So there's my shout out to the industry. Folks can contact me through the retirementmarketplace.com. You know, a couple of the barriers that we've worked through already are things like our limit on fees. Now, the Washington legislature, when they established the retirement marketplace, said, okay, one of the barriers we want to take away from small businesses is the real or perceived issue of it's too expensive to carry a retirement plan. And so all of the plans offered on the retirement marketplace, none of the plans offered on the retirement marketplace can charge an annual administrative fee to employers. Right?
Okay.
So no annual fee to employers.
Well, that's certainly an attractive thing and removes certainly the actual real cost, but also the perception of the plan is just too expensive for us to offer to our employees, which is excellent. Okay.
Yeah. And I think that, if you are able to get it to scale, I mean, you're scaling it today in Washington, but if you can get it to scale, then there's opportunities, right, for even greater cost efficiencies, right? Because you have multiple participants or employees in the plans, and there's a way to kind of diffuse the cost of, which is already negotiated through this competitive bidding process, but the ability to lower the cost over time is even more improved.
You're exactly right, Jeffrey. You know, the legislature, the other fee limit the legislature here in Washington set is that enrollees may not be charged more than a total of 100 basis points in annual administrative fees, and that's the full stack of fees, including fund management, TPA, et cetera. Now, our providers have come in nicely below that, but, some of our savers are new savers. The customers that we are reaching out to are either new savers or have very low rollover balances. So this population may be hard to serve at the margin. I know this industry is built built through scale and operates on a pretty tight margin. And so you're exactly right. The more scale we can do around customer acquisition, helping these providers reach that unserved or underserved population, then the more revenue they're going to generate and the more savings our enrollees are going to achieve.
All positive things. So this is obviously a huge undertaking and an extremely important step in the right direction. What is the feeling around your offices and just with the people that are working on this, that this is the silver bullet, that this is going to take care of the problem?
I wish I could say it would, because we think what we've done here is quite brilliant, but it is the first step in what we know will need to be a more robust and complete retirement security policy. In fact, I would say what we really need is a whole life cycle approach to financial wellness and capability for our population. And Washington State is doing an awesome job serving the school children, K-12 population with financial literacy and education. We have a great program around that population where I think we can really grow, and our research has demonstrated that working adults who are at key transitions throughout their lives, they'll have 7 to 11 careers in their lifetimes, they'll have spells of unemployment, and they have lots of budget volatility in their own households. They need support all along their life cycle in order to plan for a dignified retirement.
Carolyn, we thank you so much for sharing this information with us. And we know you're just in kind of the beginning of, you know, you just launched it, so you're starting to see the results. But would you be able to come back in a few months and check in and share some of the results that you guys have had?
Well, I'll be thrilled to do that. And I think a few months is the right approach, because I want to mention that the retirement marketplace does not collect personally identifiable information. All of the enrollment, once you find a retirement plan here that meets your needs, you're going to enroll with our private providers. And so there's some lag time in getting the data reported back to us. So we'd be thrilled to come back. In the meantime, I would love for your listeners to please visit retirementmarketplace.com after you listen to the podcast and give us some feedback. Let us know what you see, what you think, and how you'd like to see this platform evolve in the future.
Awesome.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Carolyn. We appreciate having you on the show, and we will certainly do that. We'll check back in with you very shortly.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Great. Thank you so much, guys.
Take care. Well, George, that was a great conversation with Carolyn McKinnon. So much great work being done around this country to help promote retirement readiness. It's nice to check in with people in the state of Washington. And George, as you know, I'm in Washington, D.C. I was at the NAGDA conference today, as we talked about at the top of the show. And we are joined, you know, Kevin Walsh is off today, but we are joined by his partner in crime, and I mean that very lightly, David Levine from Groom Law Group. David, how are you, my friend?
I am doing very well, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
And I know you are home based in Washington, D.C., but you are you're on the conference circuit. You're a regular conference speaker, and you're an author as well. Wondering if you might be able to share what's the latest going on in Washington, D.C. as it relates to retirement.
Sure. The latest in D.C. And when sitting down to think, well, what's new this week? There's so many headlines that are unbenefits related. Benefits, in some ways, has had a quieter week. But I think people are digesting everything. And I know Kevin has talked in previous weeks about fiduciary rule and RISA, the legislation. Congress is not passing more legislation right at this moment. The fiduciary rule, we're all waiting on the Department of Labor. So what I thought I might do this week is sort of go a little bit deeper, a little bit for plan sponsors, a little bit for service providers, and maybe talk a little bit about, if it works for y'all, about like where plan sponsors are going now after the fiduciary rule. And similarly, what are service providers looking at? And we could talk about both of those for a couple minutes.
Absolutely.
Sounds great. Why don't I just jump in? Because, you know, plan sponsors, they've been kind of in the middle, but also on the sidelines. It's kind of a catch-22. They're the ones who run all the plans that were in the middle of all the Department of Labor's discussions and all their rules. But really, they rely heavily on their service providers. So they've been sort of wondering, well, where do I go from here? And so plan sponsors right now have a couple different things that are on, in a sense, their list to think about. Number one, they've all gone through, in a lot of cases, new documents from their service providers. So what I'm talking a lot to them about is, well, what do we do now? And the first thing is breathe for a minute, because service providers are still absorbing. They're going to wait and see what the Department of Labor does. There's many people who think that they won't appeal. There's some that think they will appeal. But they need, as a plan sponsor, going to your service provider today is probably going to get a confused answer, like many out there who are just confused for good reason. But they need to start thinking, okay, if we've changed our services, we've changed our providers, Are they still going to be fiduciaries? What do the agreements say? We should need to understand what our existing agreements say. And that's the discussion that is starting to come up more and more. Like, what have we agreed to, and how does this change our agreements? Once there's a little more certainty as to where things are going, plan sponsors are also talking about starting to go back to their providers and saying, well, what does this mean now? What are you guaranteeing to us now? Are you pulling this back, like advice services or rollover services, or are you not? And that's kind of what the plan sponsors are doing. They're sort of looking at their documents and getting their house in order right now. But that seems to be a topic that's starting to rise. Does it have to be done today? No, but I think that's something that you're definitely seeing start to rise in importance. Flipping. Go ahead, please.
No, please, go ahead.
No, please.
I think that anything that prompts or motivates a plan sponsor to take a step back and to review their current process, their current plan, their provider, is probably a pretty positive thing. And I'm sure that you would probably agree that not doing anything at all and just sitting on your hands until this gets hashed out is probably the incorrect advice.
Well, I have to admit, I might beg to differ with you a little bit, because I think it really depends on the plan sponsor. If you are a big, big plan and you have lots of resources and you have very complex plans, yes, maybe now is a great time to do exactly as you say. But what if you're a small plan? What if you're someone who has a plan that has $1 million, $2 million, and you basically everything is almost automated for you? We all talk about an era of, you know, smart contracts and blockchain in the news as the topic du jour in the last 6 months. But a lot of these things are almost automated at this point. So if you're a small employer, it might be gathering your documents and just being ready to ask the questions and not doing much more. So I think there are different gradients, but you're right. One thing I absolutely agree with is it's always important to be looking forward and saying, okay, how do we review and evaluate our process? My favorite phrase in this area is whack-a-mole. A good process 5 years ago is not the same today. It's a constantly learning from what's out there. So if this gets folks to focus, whether it's this week, next month, next quarter, or even sometime this year, I think it's a positive, and you are spot on correct about that. So maybe turning a little bit also then to the discussion of service providers a little bit, because service providers are also in an interesting position, and it's probably good to take apart a couple different groups. You have your record keepers and TPAs. Some, and there's a, and they're all along a spectrum, but a lot of them are saying, now what do we do? And again, they're holding, but these are the folks that many of them are already proactively saying, if the rule stays in effect, well, if the rule is appealed, it stays in effect. Well, we already have a strategy for that. But what if the rule doesn't stay in effect? And what if the DOL decides not to appeal and it basically all drops and the rule is vacated? I think people, service providers now need to think to themselves, okay, well, I've agreed I'm a fiduciary for these services. I've reshaped my business. Let's go back and look at all the different changes I made and say, do I want to modify them, leave them as is? Because this is quasi-legal, quasi-marketing. They're, just like for the past 10 years, one of the things that's been out there is plan service providers have been selling themselves, especially in the consultant space. As I know Jeff knows really well, in the consultant space, it's been the battle of people saying, I'm a fiduciary, and then people saying, oh, I'm not a fiduciary, and the 31 flavors in between of where I'm a fiduciary for X but not for Y. Everybody kind of reshuffled for the fiduciary rule, and if that does get vacated, where are you a fiduciary? Where are you not? What does your paperwork say? What do you want to be? And also, what's the interaction going to be with the plan sponsors about how you're changing or not changing your business? I think that there's the legal change, but you're going to see people marketing, oh, I'm keeping up this approach because I believe in it. And there'll be other people who say, we're not doing this because it didn't make sense to do it, and here's why, and we think it's better for you. There's probably no wrong or right on any of these, but I think that's, and I know for a fact, that's what record keepers are and TPAs are grappling with. Consultants, same type of thing. As consultants have evolved, most plan sponsors look to their consultants as a big intermediary with a lot of people. And the consultants, I'll call it the traditional consultants who just sort of have done the traditional advice, and you have a committee or an individual or the company just generically who selects investments and vendors, but a lot of consultants have rolled out their own products and other designs. And while the new fiduciary rule was challenging for some, it actually created opportunities for others. And so now there's a discussion on the consultants of what does this mean for the products or the services I've done, especially if you get into discretionary services or other activities, because there's all these old exemptions, and we can debate what's coming back to life or not. Our firm view at this point is the old exemptions and the old rule kind of springs back, but if it's vacated. But there's all these old exemptions that allow people to sell some of these services they created in light of the fiduciary rule using the best interest contract exemption. So it leads to an interesting discussion. I can get really wonky, but that probably is not a bad place to stop because that's probably wonky enough for an audience.
No, I think it's all great. I think the other takeaway, all this uncertainty, and I think about all the money that was spent, you know, so you mentioned, you know, these the concepts you were kind of outlining, but like the money spent by these service providers to create these new operational procedures or to create new tools, right? And all that kind of, you know, you have to decide whether you're going to keep it or dump it or not use it. But I think about that the loss of capital, right? That money could have been used for other areas of the business to improve record keeping services or improve, tools that you had online. And, you know, so, you know, I mean, obviously it's a use of capital and it's certainly necessary, but you know, that's a result of this uncertainty as well.
You're spot on, right. And there was a lot of discussion about people saying I can't do this or that because I'm so focused on the fiduciary rule. This could also lead to a whole other round of that, especially when the SEC comes out with its proposal, because my personal guess is it's not going to be all encompassing like the DOL rule. I think it's going to be a rule that covers brokers and advisors, but it doesn't cover everybody in this universe who is covered by the fiduciary rule. And it's also going to, and I think it's going to be more maybe about, like we've heard publicly, it could be more about how you describe who you are. And it may not be as much of a burden, but there's so many different pieces layered on with the state initiatives, which could be more discussion for another time. A lot of innovation could be refocused on compliance for a while. In a sense, we're starting all over again.
Back to the drawing board.
Exactly.
Well, David, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, David. And we'll talk to you very soon.
Thank you so much.
Well, George, David Levine was spectacular. All of our guests this week were spectacular. We went from markets to personal finance to retirement marketplace and on a high note with David Levine talking about this fiduciary rule and the impact of providers and plan sponsors alike. I mean, it's amazing. What a way to go into a weekend.
Yep, totally agree. A lot of great content, a lot of great information again. So very grateful for all of our super smart, super engaging guests.
Yeah, so let me ask you a question. Did you finish your green tea?
I was the whole time wishing that my headset had a long enough cord that I could have gone and gotten a refill. So yeah, I certainly finished it minutes and minutes ago, Jeff.
Well, I want to tell the audience how much I appreciate doing this with you, because I don't think they're completely aware. You also, in addition to serving as a co-host, are also doing the producing of this. So you kind of take the work that we do with our different guests and kind of marry it all together, so it sounds very seamless. So I wanted to say thank you for that. And I think they also may not be aware that you also have your own podcast. Well, they're probably aware of that, but that you also have your own podcast that you orchestrate and work on. So I think I just want them to know how thankful I am to have the opportunity to work with you.
Well, that's awfully nice. And I have very much enjoyed the last couple of weeks and excited to keep it going. And thank you so much, because you're the person who's put this whole thing together. So,
well, I appreciate that. So you enjoy your time with your family. Have a great weekend and enjoy the rest of your day on this very nice Friday.
All right, brother. Talk soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.